Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics, and we've got two interviews lined up tonight. First, about 6 or 7 minutes, we'll speak with Rob Weissman, author of a new report. He is with Essential Information, and they have a Wall Street Watch program, and they have a big new report looking at Wall Street's political contributions and the deregulation it bought them, and all these things that gave rise to the current financial and economic crisis, which just goes on and on and on. Rob Weissman, also editor of Multinational Monitor. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with James Horney, who is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, about Barack Obama's first proposed budget. Before all that, some comments on the economic news. I've been off the air at WBAI for the last 3 weeks, though I've been doing shows for KPFA during that hiatus. I can now disclose to the New York audience that the economy has not recovered since I was last here. In fact, it's not even starting to find its footing. And when I say the economy, a phrase I sometimes recklessly use, as if getting and spending weren't somehow embedded deeply in social life, but just something existing above and apart from human affairs. When I say the economy, I don't mean just the U.S. Most of the world economy is sinking rapidly, in many cases more rapidly than it is here. But since I live in the U.S., I do pay closest attention to what goes on here, and what's been going on here isn't very good. Car sales are down more than 40% from a year ago to the lowest levels in modern history. That may be good news for the atmosphere, but not much else. Until we make a transition to a post-carbon world, the huge portion of our economy, heavily concentrated in the Midwest, that depends upon making motor vehicles, will be on the ropes. Housing, too, continues to sink and gives no real sign of stabilizing at all. The Institute for Supply Management surveys of purchasing managers, the people who buy things for corporations, a source that I quote here quite frequently, these surveys look awful. The ISM's manufacturing index was flat in February, but its employment component sank to an all-time low, and it's a survey that goes back almost 60 years. Their service sector survey, which has only a 12-year history, fell slightly for February. Cheeringly, if it's not a meaningless blip, that survey's employment component rose slightly, suggesting that maybe just about everyone who could be laid off already has been. Not really, of course, but it's tempting to think that. And on Thursday morning, we learned that the first-time claims for unemployment insurance, a very timely and sensitive indicator of the state of the job market, fell last week, suggesting a somewhat slower pace of job loss, although it remains at quite a high level. This thing does bounce around from week to week, so it's best to average the last 4 weeks' results to get a better fix on what's going on. That measure rose slightly from its previous reading. Putting all this together, it looks like the economy is still declining, though the rate of decline is no longer accelerating. Add to that some signs of stabilization in the Economic Cycles Research Institute's leading index, which is designed to forecast turns in the U.S. economy 3 to 6 months ahead, and you've got some straws to grasp at. My best guess is still that the recession won't bottom out for another 6 to 12 months. The economy is going to get a lift from the stimulus package, whose scores of billions will start hitting the economy in a matter of weeks. But I suspect that any stabilization won't be followed by a quick recovery, but instead by a long, grinding period of flatness that will feel to most of us like a continuing recession. This is, without a doubt, not just an ordinary business cycle, but instead a sign of a structural shift. The old neoliberal model of deregulation and debt-fueled consumption and speculation is dead beyond revival. It's going to take a whole new economic model to get things going again, and I hope that new model will have a large green and social democratic component. Oh, and some bad news for those of you who care about such things. I've just worked up some long-term analyses of the stock market, which compares prices to their long-term trends and to underlying corporate profits. On both measures, the market was overvalued by record dimensions, and I'm looking at a history that goes back to 1871, so this is not a short-term history. Overvalued by record dimensions at the peak of the dot-com mania in 2000. It's come well off those highs, not surprising, considering that it's down about 50% over the last year, but it's still 30 to 40% above a level it's been at troughs of earlier major bear markets. And while day-to-day movements in stock prices don't matter much for those not in the market, big long-term moves do reflect and set an economic tone. Another big leg downward in the stock market would suggest that any signs of economic stabilization were mere false positives, and there'll be more bloodletting on the way. I hope not, but that's what this history suggests. And now a special update added for the KPFA and podcast audiences. Friday morning brought the release of the U.S. employment report for February from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and it was another major stinker. You have to work really hard to find a single consoling detail hidden beneath the wretched headline numbers. The monthly report is assembled from two separate surveys, one of employers and one of households, the highlights of each. The employer survey reports a loss of 651,000 jobs last month, the third consecutive month of losses north of 600,000. It would be four consecutive months had November's loss been just 3,000 higher. Goods production led the way down, with construction off 104,000 and manufacturing 168,000. But it wasn't just the goods sector that got hammered. Private services fell by 384,000. Retail, transportation, finance, leisure and hospitality, and professional and business services all took major hits. Even healthcare, which has been in a tireless expansion, added just 27,000 jobs, a weak number by its own standards. Since the recession began in December 2007, employment is off by almost 4.5 million, or 3.2%. That's not a record breaker, though it's now slightly ahead of the losses of the early 1980s recession, now remembered as a savage one. It still has some work to do to catch up with the losses of the 1948, 49, and 1957, 58 downturns. These records are now well within hailing distance. The household survey looked about as bad as the survey of employers. The share of the adult population at work fell to its lowest level since 1985, meaning that what was once celebrated as the great American job machine is now very badly broken. The unemployment rate rose to 8.1%, its highest level since 1983. Hidden unemployment also rose, with those working part-time for economic reasons, that is, people who want to work full-time but can only find part-time work, up 838,000 and up almost 4 million on a year. The broadest measure of unemployment, which the BLS calls the U6 rate, which includes unwilling part-timers and discouraged workers, that is, people who've dropped out of the labor force because they find the job search to be hopeless, that rose almost a full point to 14.8%, and that near 15% measure is probably a much more accurate picture than the official headline number would suggest. And the forward-looking indicators in this report, like temp and retail employment, and the length of the average work week, which is now at record lows, all these are pointing towards more weakness in the coming months. Let's hope that the stimulus money, which starts hitting the economy in a few weeks, puts the brakes on this slide, because otherwise we're in deep trouble. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk with Rob Weissman.
I'll have two eggs over light, homemade apple pie, cold slaw as a side order. You gotta stay fit, stay alive, eat food to sustain a non-stop high-grade performer. Pieces continue, sure keeps running me down.
And that's some of the Kinks' Maximum Consumption from their 1972 album, Everybody's in Showbiz. Okay, now we're joined on the air by, on the line rather, by Rob Weissman, who is, among other things, editor of Multinational Monitor and the lead author of a report called Sold Out, which they've just published on Wall Street's political contributions and the massive deregulation program that it earned them. Welcome, Rob.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And also, Rob is the new father of a five-week-old kid, so as a sentimentalist now about children myself, congratulations, Rob.
Thanks very much.
Okay, so first of all, before we start, where can people download this report from, assuming they're going to be, I'm assuming they're going to develop a compelling interest in its contents?
I hope they do. They can get it at wallstreetwatch.org. It's a long report, but there's short executive summary available to wallstreetwatch.org.
Wallstreetwatch.org, and I'll say that at the end of the segment as well. So first of all, before we go into the details of deregulation, just, a stunning number. I was going to say it's very large. In some sense, it is. Over $5 billion that Wall Street spent over the last decade on lobbying and political contributions. But by the standards of Wall Street, you know, that's a few CEOs' bonuses. So, you know, they got a lot for their money, didn't they?
They did, although here in Washington, if you could put a B in front of it, it still seems like a big number. So $5 billion over a 10-year period in campaign contributions and lobbying, pretty significant. And and gave them a massive presence on Capitol Hill and in the executive agencies.
And something like 3,000 lobbyists working for them?
Yeah, we looked at 2007, we counted 3,000 lobbyists, and that was not double counting. So if you were a lobbyist hired by two separate Wall Street firms, we only counted you once. If we didn't avoid that double counting, we would get up almost to 7,000.
So who is doing all this hiring? It's all the brand names, some of whom are on government life support right now, right?
Yeah, I mean, Citigroup, of course, is really at the top of the list, along with Goldman Sachs, is the most influential, and I think Citi, because of its connection to Robert Rubin after he left the Clinton Treasury Department, and because now it's so much dependent on public money, the worst exemplar of the intermix of Wall Street and government, the ability of Wall Street to influence government to get direct results benefiting those firms.
How does Wall Street stack up against other industrial sectors?
It's pretty high. I think if you take the broad healthcare sector and you include everything from the pharmaceutical companies to the health insurance companies to the hospitals, it may come in slightly higher. Except for that, I think that the financial sector is the biggest. Admittedly, the financial sector itself is a broad category that includes accounting firms, insurance companies, commercial banks, and investment banks.
But they have many common and compelling interests together, don't they?
They do, and they've thanks to some of the regulatory reforms they won, they are more intermixed than ever.
And how do they spread this around? Now, if you watch Keith Olbermann, it's all about the last 8 years, but they're a little more ecumenical than that, weren't they?
Yeah, well, if you just look at the money, it's about 55-45% breakdown favoring the Republicans, but that really attracts the fact that the Republicans were in power. Certain segments of the industry are pretty democratic, including especially the high citadels of Wall Street. In the 2008 election, it was about 50-50, a slight advantage, I think 51-49 for the Democrats.
And they really don't have partisan affiliation so much as they just follow the polls, don't they?
Yeah, certain industries, track either more Democratic or more Republican, but the overwhelming trend is that they go to who's in power.
And do they concentrate these contributions on particular persons, or do they just spread it all around, like dropping money from a helicopter, as Bernanke famously
said? Quite a phrase, yeah. Well, if you've got $5 billion, you can do a little bit of both. They certainly concentrate the money on the presidential candidates and their favorite presidential candidates, and then on the key members of Congress, especially those on the Senate Banking Committee and the House Financial Services Committee.
And did they have any favorites in the presidential campaign?
Well, they were pretty happy, I think, at least from the Wall Street side, with all the Democratic contenders, especially Obama and Clinton did very well.
I think they probably made the rational judgment that a Democrat was going to win, so they didn't want to back a loser.
And there's also, the companies themselves are not able to make contributions except through their PACs. And we talk about the company money. It's really the contributions made by employees of those firms.
But a lot of those are not random events, right? These are like organized.
A lot of it's organized,
parties, right?
But not yet, through social networks or through more formal incentives and directions from the higher-ups in the companies. But there are cultures in those companies. And so, Wall Street's a liberal, socially liberal place, so they would, all things being equal, they probably prefer the Democrats.
And what were their obsessions? What did they, over that decade, what were they hoping to get done in Washington for all their billions?
Well, they wanted to roll back any regulation that would stand in their way from doing anything it is that they wanted to do. We track things back over the last decade, and I think the signal event really was the formal repeal of Glass-Steagall, which was the Depression-era law that had prohibited commercial banks and investment banks from being intertwined, from being held by the same holding companies. And that, a related law also prohibited insurance companies and commercial banks from being combined. That stood in the way of a merger between Citibank and Travelers Group. They merged anyway in 1998.
Before the law was changed.
Before the law was changed, on the assumption that they would be able to win a change in the law. The industry spent about $150 million that year trying to work on it. Robert Rubin, who favored the change while he was Treasury Secretary, stepped down as Treasury Secretary, helped broker a deal because there were a lot of technical and regulatory jurisdictional issues that threatened to prevent passage of the law. He brokered a deal when he was still being viewed as a master of the universe and as an independent public servant, not revealing that he was at the time negotiating a deal to become an executive at the newly merged Citigroup, which he position he soon took thereafter.
Yeah, I mean, that if there's a case study of just how things work, I mean, you can't beat that one. I mean,
you can't beat that, and then to know that we knew that he helped oversee a company that drove itself into the ground, and that became one of the top advisors to the Democratic president 8 years later. It's just unbelievable.
It's really an unbelievable sequence because they merged ahead of the law. They knew they were going to get the law changed, and then one of the engineers of that legal transformation gets a big job with them, and he does a terrible job when he's there. So it's an amazing story of American success. All right, so your report also details 12 major aspects, kind of dirty dozen, of deregulation, the steps that really paved the way to our financial meltdown that we're in right now. First of all, you first mentioned the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. What did that contribute to the present disaster?
Well, I think the ultimate thing was it really infused the investment banking culture, the speculative investment culture, into commercial banking, which, if you think about it, ought to be an awfully easy place to earn a pretty good income without doing a lot of hard work. I mean, you're just taking people's money and you're loaning it out for more. It's just not that hard. But the lure of super high returns, which commercial banking sector should be prohibited from because they are using depositor money and it's federally insured, was a temptation that was too great for them to resist. And I think as a result of Glass-Steagall, you saw some new kinds of institutional structures were able to do things they couldn't have been able to do before, but also especially that there was this cultural transformation. And it's not as if bankers weren't greedy in the first place, but a different kind of mindset took over and helped get these guys into trouble that they are now trying to buy their way out of.
Well, at one point, I mean, this is, I'm exaggerating slightly, but in the decades after the Depression, the banking industry was regulated kind of like a utility in the way that we used to regulate utilities before we deregulated them. You could make money, but it was not a place to accumulate spectacular wealth. It was kind of sleepy, and that all changed, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things we point to is the merger mania that took place over the last 30 years and actually has even accelerated to some considerable extent during the meltdown as the government has helped broker all these mergers of different firms. But one thing that happened, of course, is that you had concentration of the industry into ever bigger and bigger firms, with now four great giants, of which Citigroup is one, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America being the others. But even the ones that aren't quite at that level have achieved a systemic importance, and so they are now described both colloquially and also almost technically as too big to fail. The government can't let them go down, or the whole system might crash. Once you get to that level of size, which, you know, our view is never should have been permitted, but once you get to that level of size, you've got to regulate them as public utilities because you've given them this implicit government guarantee that they are, in fact, too big to fail, and you must prevent them from doing risky things that could bring them down and therefore threaten the system, and the government just failed to do that. They failed on both sides, both by permitting the mergers and then imposing any of the regulations and enforcing existing regulations to protect the public from the disaster that we're now in.
I speak with Rob Weissman, who is editor of Multinational Monitor and also lead author of a report called Sold Out, available from WallStreetWatch.org.
That's right.
Okay. And this is a little arcane, but it's rather important. All these strange vehicles that the banks have on their balance sheets, well, not on their balance sheets, off their balance sheets, they were not really properly accounted for. Tell us why that matters and how that got to be.
Well, it is arcane, and there's all these bizarre terms about what the banks are doing, but I think there's also a really common sense way to look at it, which is that if you're a corporation, you're supposed to present on your balance sheet what it is you own and what it is you owe, and if you start hiding those facts from investors and from the public, no one really understands what's going on, and that is, in fact, what the commercial banks did increasingly over the last decade, relying on obscure accounting rules that were done by this quasi-regulatory agency that they influenced. So they kept all of what's now called, what are viewed as toxic assets, primarily off the balance sheet in these special purpose vehicles that were kind of a black hole, sort of an accounting black hole. No one really knew what was inside of them, even though the bank still had all these liabilities.
And, of course, they didn't have to set aside any capital reserves to cover losses there either.
That's right.
How did that come to be? How did they get away with it?
Well, there's a this now takes us into the technical part of the story. There's something called the Federal the Financial Accounting Standards Board, which adopted a rule in 1983 and then revised it over time that dealt with when you could have off-balance sheet entities. The theory of doing this for commercial banks, and commercial banks have ability to use these things that's greater than other corporations, especially after post-Enron reforms. The idea is if they were going to pool their mortgages and then sell them off into these asset-backed securities, these mortgage-backed securities, that they would put them in some new structure and then people would, or investors would buy pieces of this, these new combined mortgages, and the banks wouldn't have any more control or liability for what was going on with those mortgages. But that turned out to be a complete fiction. Through a variety of reasons, they still had liability for what was inside of these allegedly off-balance, or what was inside of these off-balance sheet vehicles. And those are the things that are the toxic assets. The reason that people don't really understand if the banks are insolvent or not is partly because it depends on whether how you predict the future is going to go with mortgages, but also partly because people don't know what it is the banks own and what they don't own.
Okay, and then there are several efforts to regulate derivatives, these complicated products that even professionals don't fully understand. But they were blocked at several turns, weren't they?
They were blocked from any regulatory effort. And this is, again, a story where the Democrats are as guilty as the Republicans. There was an effort within the Clinton administration through a small agency called the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which regulates traditional derivatives, which is like futures and oranges or wheat or something, to also try to impose some really modest regulations on financial derivatives, primarily with the idea of just getting a fix on what was going on in this exploding area, even then, of the financial markets. They were crushed in their effort to do it by the combination of Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, and with the assistance of Alan Greenspan. And the head of the agency resigned basically over this issue because she wasn't able to get any regulatory authority. The new person who came in went along with this non-regulatory approach. Then in 2000, Senator Phil Graham, Republican from Texas, engineered a law, the Commodity Modernization.
Whose wife once headed the CFTC herself.
Yes, his wife had the job running the agency that he defanged, prohibiting them for all time until we get this law repealed from regulating financial derivatives. And as a result, you've got this massive explosion, more than $650 trillion in financial derivatives spewing about the planet, no one really understanding who owes what to whom or why. And there's just not even any tracking of what it is that is going on, let alone any controls over whether these instruments should be permitted to exist or not.
And then moving down your dirty dozen list here, we've got a couple of failures, even deliberate failures, to regulate predatory lending practices that have now proven to be so disastrous.
Yeah, and I think if you look at the predatory lending story, one of the interesting pieces is that it's not as if no one knew that predatory lending was going on until 2006, when subprime lending became and predatory lending became prominent in the news. Consumer groups and community groups were complaining about predatory lending in the 1990s and sounding very serious alarm bells by 2001.
To pat myself on the back, we had people on this show who made those claims years and years ago. So,
and we
this
just
is
thought,
not unknown.
Yeah, and there was something that very close to approaching zero regulation by the federal authorities. The Federal Reserve, which has got a lot of authority in this area, took exactly three formal actions against predatory lenders from 2002 to 2007. The Office of Comptroller of the Currency, which has authority over 1,800 banks which are nationally chartered, also took three consumer protection actions during 2004 to 2006. They just were averting their eyes from this stuff.
So six moves against millions of transactions.
Yeah. And then at the same time, when the states tried to step into the breach, the same entities, not the Fed, but the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency and the one, the related agency that has authority over savings loans over thrifts, the Office of Thrift Supervision, told the states that they could not regulate federally chartered lending institutions. So they preempted the efforts by the states to do anything about these abuses, and they went ahead.
Now, if you listen to right-wing radio or Republican Party, the major culprits in creating this disaster were Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and, of course, the Community Reinvestment Act. The last one is so ludicrous that it's hardly worth talking about. But Fannie and Freddie are, to some degree, related to this crisis. Put it in perspective and tell us just how they fit in.
Well, Fannie and Freddie have a job of in a weird space, at least they used to be, which is that they were private corporations, but they were government chartered, and they had a public mission and widely perceived to have government backing. They were supposed to be buying up loans so that banks could make more loans, but only investing in prime loans. They also had a mission of trying to make home mortgages more available to lower and moderate income people. But they had sort of this public-oriented mission in the context of a private corporation. It was always attention, and they engaged in a series of abuses where they pushed up against that mission and also against the special regulatory restraints that were against them. What they ended up doing was buying, not so much directly buying up subprime loans from mortgage originators, but they became very major players in the secondary market, buying up a lot of the combined these big pools of mortgages and these mortgage-backed securities, at some points making up about half of the market for these things. And I think the big result was that they gambled themselves into ruin. Unfortunately, because of their size and special role, the government couldn't just stand by and watch them collapse, but they've now put in a few hundred billion dollars in public money to keep these things on life support.
And they're also the credit rating agencies. What didn't they do that they should have?
Well, a colleague says we should stop calling them credit rating agencies because it makes it sound like they're some kind of public institution. They are not. They're credit. They have the job of rating.
But they do have some sort of quasi-public role.
Government agencies rely on them to make assessments. But they are for-profit companies. In fact, one of them, there's only three of them that have a substantial role. One of them is Moody's, which is the single most profitable Fortune 500 company for a few years in the boom years of the 2000s. What they did was basically give very good ratings to a lot of very bad bonds. That deceived investors, but it was also really important because a lot of public agencies and pension funds are not able to invest in bonds unless they are rated highly by these credit rating firms. So when they gave high ratings to poor quality stuff, it gave the authorization for all of these pools of public money to go in, as well as signals to private investors as well who were deceived in the process. The reason that they failed wasn't just they were stupid, although maybe they are, but because they're paid by the companies that issue the bonds. They had a direct conflict of interest and they were compromised. There's a lot of information coming out in the last few months of internal emails where you had some of these people at the desks sending notes back and forth to each other saying, you know, we're really rating a cow here. We'd say anything with AAA if we were being paid to do it. You know, what purpose are we serving in life here?
Right. Well, we've only got a minute left, but is there a way out of this? I mean, what you describe is so vast and the scope of deregulation is so vast that how do we re-regulate this thing?
Well, you know, the first step is to undo all of these things. And we're going to have a big fight in Congress in the course of this next year. But I think we need really a fundamental shift. We got to say first re-regulation, but there's got to be some specificity about what needs to be done. I think overarching framework ideas have to be the financial sector has to be a much smaller portion of the economy. It mushroomed way out of control. So I think one way to get there is through a financial transactions tax so that there's less room for speculative activity and slows down the churning of all the stocks and bonds that are going back and forth. I think there ought to be prohibitions on a lot of these exotic financial instruments that serve no useful social purpose but have brought down the entire global economy. And new ones that are going to be introduced ought to get pre-approval from government regulators where they show that they're not going to pose those kind of threats in the future. And, you know, we also need to be thinking about how we get credit to people through institutions that make sense. There needs to be a lot more support for credit unions and to displace some of these large banks that we don't need to do some of the sort of basic banking functions. And finally, consumers need to be given tools to organize themselves so they've got their own organizations to monitor, litigate, and organize against the abuses from Wall Street and the rest of the financial sector.
All right, thank you. I've been speaking with Rob Weissman, who is the editor of Multinational Monitor and the lead author of a new report called Sold Out on Wall Street lobbying and the deregulation that it bought them, and that available from wallstreetwatch.org, wallstreetwatch.org. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web at kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program, Behind the News. All right, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk fiscal politics. That was some of the, what is it, Toccata in C minor, BWV 911, of Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Martha Argerich. And we're now joined on the line by James Horney, who is the Director of Federal Fiscal Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
So, I guess we don't really have the full formal budget proposal out yet, right? Is this some sort of preliminary draft document?
This is preliminary because this is what normally happens when you have a new administration coming in. Ordinarily, the full budget is sent to Congress no later than the first Monday in February. But since the president is not inaugurated until near the end of January, it's not possible to put together a full budget. But just as George W. Bush and Bill Clinton did in recent years, President Obama has sent up a fairly detailed blueprint of what he is proposing. It doesn't include all of the details, which will be delivered in about a month, but it certainly gives you a clear indication of the policies that he wants to pursue and how his budget adds up.
Yeah, and I think probably a lot of the listeners are not familiar with just what the process is. The president proposes a budget, which sort of sets the tone for debate, but he can propose all he wants. It's the Congress is what disposes, right?
It's absolutely. At the end of the day, the Constitution gives the power of the purse to the Congress. It's also important to know that unlike what happens at least in some states and some foreign countries, the president does not send up a single budget bill, which is then debated, and when that bill is enacted, the entire budget is in place. The Congress actually considers the president's budget in many, many different packages. The first thing they do, which they will be starting to work on, actually starting to work now, but they hope to pass within four to 6 weeks or so, is something called the Congressional Budget Resolution. And it's actually not a law. It's just an agreement between the House and the Senate that basically says here are the priorities that the Congress has adopted for the budget. And it provides a blueprint for the consideration of subsequent legislation, appropriation bills, tax bills, and bills dealing with Medicare, Medicaid, and so on, that will be considered throughout the year and that actually all together constitute what will be the budget. When you're done at the end of the year, the changes that have been made in taxes, changes in Medicare, Medicaid, plus the 12 separate appropriation bills that fund most of sort of the basic activities of government, including almost all of defense, whole bunch of different bills are enacted at the end of the year. You add them all together, and that's the budget.
And a lot of the detailed work is done in relevant committees, right?
That's right. That's right. That basically what happens. The first step is this budget resolution I was talking about. That's in the jurisdiction in the House of the House Budget Committee. In the Senate, there's a budget committee. So they consider it, but it really is just a blueprint. It doesn't have all the details. It says, here's the total amount of spending and revenues that we think are appropriate. Here are the priorities for spending. And so that is adopted, and that, say, those committees have jurisdiction sort of over the whole budget. But from there on, it breaks down into various committees. So each House has an appropriation committee that provides the funding. About roughly a third to 40% of the total funding is so-called discretionary appropriations. And discretionary doesn't mean that they're things we could live with or live without. It means it is are programs where the funding is determined annually in appropriation bills, where you decide how much to spend. Then the other spending is controlled by various committees that have jurisdiction over programs like Medicare, like the farm programs. And in those cases, those are programs that operate under continuing law. You set benefit levels and eligibility standards. And in order to get savings there, or if you want to expand those programs, you have to change that underlying law. If you don't make any changes in an entitlement program like Medicare, then it simply continues to operate under current rules, which is essentially the same thing for the tax code, too, where you have tax laws in place, and you change those laws only to the extent you want to change the current policies.
Which, of course, is not easy to do.
That's right. I mean, getting anything that's at all controversial through the Congress is not easy. That was apparently the intent of the Founding Fathers. They didn't set the system up to make it easy, and perhaps it's gotten even harder over time as you have a proliferation of interest groups that rally up against anything that they think might be harmful to their interest.
And back in the days when Ronald Reagan was president and Democrats ran the Congress, they used to pronounce his budgets dead on arrival. This one is not dead on arrival, is it?
I don't think it is dead. I would also have to say that Reagan's were not dead on arrival, at least in the first few years. His first year in office, he was very successful in pushing through a very, very big tax cut and also a number of spending cuts that he wanted. Later, there was resistance to continuing to do the things he wanted, and so there were years where was dead on arrival. But certainly, no, this one is not dead on arrival. It really represents a change for a number of years now after the first year or so of the Bush administration. The budgets that President Bush sent up were predictable, and if not completely dead on arrival, they really didn't contain major policy changes that had much chance at all of being enacted. So it became sort of a ritual. The budget came up, and Republicans would talk about how they supported it, Democrats would oppose it, but at the end of the day, not a whole lot got done. In this instance, it's different. It's a combination of the fact that we have Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate, and a Democrat president that is very popular, and pent-up demand. I mean, there are a number of issues that there's widespread agreement needs to be addressed. Health care in the country, expanding health care coverage, climate change, problems with global warming, problem that the budget is facing a very serious long-term problem of rising deficits. And so, you know, many people have been waiting for a new president to come in and make proposals to try to deal with those issues. And so it does make this year quite a bit different from what we've faced in recent years.
Now, in the early 20th century, there's a German sociologist whose name escapes me who said that the government's budget is the state stripped bare of all its ideological pretenses. It's the skeleton of the state. It's really what it's, you know, what it really is all about, the fundamentals. You can strip, take away all the rhetoric, and this is, but the budget is really, you know, the hardcore stuff. What does this budget tell you about the hardcore of the Obama administration?
I think what it tells you is that he is very serious about addressing what he views as major problems facing the country. He has proposed a health care reform plan with not much details. It's mostly principles. He apparently thinks the best way to make progress on this is not to send up a detailed health reform proposal as President Clinton did in 1994, and then the Congress felt like they had been left out of the decision-making process. So I think here he thinks the best way to do it is a set of principles. And also, very importantly, he proposed a couple of proposals that would, to a large extent, help fund the cost of the health reform. One is a package of cuts in Medicare and other health programs, including things like ending overpayments to private health insurance companies that provide Medicare services but are overpaid by about 14% relative to what is paid for the same beneficiaries who are covered by fee-for-service.
Just to draw that out,
sure.
I was stunned when I read that in the paper the other day that for these HMO Medicare schemes, the government pays 14% more than it does for traditional. Now, I thought the virtues of these HMOs is they're supposed to save money. But
well,
here is the government increasing its spending by, what, more than an eighth.
Yeah, that's why it's so striking that this was done. The original idea was you would have these so-called Medicare Advantage companies, private insurers that would agree for a set fee per person to provide the services that Medicare provides. And the idea was they would do it more efficiently. And when this program was initially set up, the plan was to pay them less than you paid for Medicare fee for service, where Medicare is reimbursing hospitals and doctors directly for services they provide. But over time, it got perverted, and in the 2003 Medicare prescription drug bill, they put in, the supporters of these private companies put in provisions that led to them being, by estimates of the nonpartisan Congressional Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, being overpaid by 14%. In other words, paying 14% more than we would be paying if the people were being covered by the Medicare fee-for-service. It makes no sense at all, and I think it was largely driven
unless you're a stockholder in HMO.
Unless you are, and I think it was largely driven by ideological interest of the Republicans who were in charge at that time, who have a preference for private companies providing these services rather than Medicare, which Medicare never, hires the doctors and the hospitals or anything directly. They simply reimburse them. But the Republicans had a preference for getting these private health insurance companies involved. And say the nonpartisan MedPAC unanimously said these overpayments should be stopped. We should level the playing field. The president proposed these cuts, which, there are defenders of these programs. They're going to fight fiercely against it. He also proposed a limitation on the value of itemized deductions for people with very high incomes, people with incomes of more than $250,000 a year who are paying the top two rates. Together, those things would raise about $650 billion over 10 years, which would go a long way toward funding the health care reform the president wants. So anyway, what the president showed was he's very serious about this by proposing some tough ways to pay for the health care reform, putting out a number of principles. In a number of other areas, he did similar things where he put out some very tough kinds of proposals saying we're going to have to pay for these things. We need in the short run, meaning over the next 10 years, get the deficit down from the really high levels we have now, and then put in place things that will allow us to start dealing with the long-term deficit problem, which is largely driven by the rising cost of health care in this country system-wide, private and public.
I'm speaking with James Horney, who is the Director of Federal Fiscal Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in D.C. Now, there have been a lot of grand pronouncements about this budget. David Leonhardt, writing in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, said it marked a tremendous departure from the priorities of the last 20, 25 years. Some commentators have said it's as much of a departure as Reaganism was from what went before it, and the New Deal was from what went before it. Some columnists have said, despite all his moderate talk, Obama now through this budget demonstrate himself an old-fashioned, big-spending liberal. Would you agree with these diagnoses?
I would agree that it's a real change in the priorities we've seen in the last 8 years. First of all, in addressing these big problems and willing to say, hey, look, we need to take these on, and if that means raising some revenues from high-income people who can afford to pay more taxes, that's a good thing to do, cutting these overpayments to these insurance companies. The second is, in general, it does represent a sort of at least moving back to where we were 8 years ago and undoing some of the things that have happened in 8 years where you had big tax cuts that were overwhelmingly targeted at high-income people. So over a period of years and actually for several decades now, where people at the lower end of the income scale have seen their incomes go up much more slowly than those at the top, we then, 8 years ago and 6 years ago, added on top of that big tax cuts for the highest income people. What Obama is saying is that, look, this is not the right priorities for this country, that it is the lower and middle income Americans who need tax relief. He provides that. He does have refundable credits, expands the child tax credit, the earned income tax credit, has his making work pay tax credit that goes up through the middle class. And he does ask higher income people to pay more, not to extend the big tax cuts for the top two brackets that they got in 2001, and to put some limitations on some of the tax breaks that they get.
Those Bush tax cuts expire in 2010. And,
that's correct.
Those are
yes.
almost certain to expire now, aren't they?
Well, what I think is what President Obama has proposed, and I think it's likely to happen, is that the reductions that were made in the top two brackets, 39.6% bracket, 36 that were lowered to 35 and 33, that he would let those expire as scheduled under current law. There were other changes as well that benefited middle-income people, but also helped higher-income people, but reductions in, for instance, a new 10% bracket, some marriage penalty relief, and some other things. And President Obama has proposed to extend those. I think it's virtually certain that those breaks will be extended, and I think it's likely that, in fact, the top income bracket reductions will not be extended as he proposed.
And then there is the complex issue of the carbon cap and trade system.
Right.
Tell us about that.
What the president has proposed is a deficit neutral climate change problem that would be based on a cap and trade system. And what he says is we need to limit the amount of greenhouse gases that can be emitted, that's the way we have to do that in order to slow down global warming. And he recognizes that by putting these limits on these emissions, it will raise energy prices because we won't be able to use the cheapest alternative as much of oil and coal and so on. So it will raise energy prices. But what he has proposed is that we have offsets that would go to lower and moderate income people to help them offset those increased energy costs. So he is planning on dedicating his making work pay tax credit to provide that assistance, and that would come out of the revenues that would be raised by auctioning off the allowances to greenhouse gas emitting industries. But he's also said there would need to be some additional relief and would also use the other part of the money that's collected in auctioning these allowances to do that. This is a big step forward. We're, you know, absolutely convinced by the scientific evidence. We're here at the center are not experts on science, but in reading and talking to people who are experts, convinced this needs to be done. And the recognition here that you, as a result of the policies that will limit the greenhouse gas emissions, you will have an increase in energy prices, and that what we need to do to make sure that this moves forward is make sure that low and moderate income people are not adversely affected. They'll still face those higher energy prices, and they'll have incentives to consume less of that energy, but they will get money that will help offset the fact that they have to pay those higher prices.
And if we do want to reduce carbon emissions, we have to make the stuff more expensive. There's really no other way to get about that, is it?
That's exactly right. I mean, there are people who try to talk about ways to do it without raising those prices. But at the end of the day, if we emit less of those gases, it is going to raise the price of energy. Now, in the long run, the hope is that new technologies will be developed and that, you know, some years from now we will find other lower-cost alternatives. But the reality is that over, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, it is virtually unavoidable unless there's some dramatic breakthrough, scientific breakthrough, unavoidable that by limiting these emissions, we are going to raise energy prices. And therefore, if we want to be successful in this, we have to own up to that, and we have to figure out a way where people are not made worse off as a result of that increase in energy.
And then there's a matter that I guess a lot of people can't get excited about, but except for geeks like me. But this is a far more honest budget than what we've become used to, isn't it?
It is much more honest. We became used to, in recent years, a budget that would come out that left out some very large cost of things that everybody knew were going to happen President Bush would not, at the beginning, he wouldn't include any cost for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. He eventually started putting in money.
Those were funded by, like, emergency resolutions. They're kind of off budget, right?
Each year. Well, it's not off budget so much, but he didn't include it in his regular budget, and they have not been funded through the regular appropriation bills. They end up showing up in the budget, so it's not that after the fact we're denying the money was spent. But when he sent up his budgets, he did not include the real cost, particularly the cost, say, 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now. Similarly, he pretended that we were not going to extend relief from the alternative minimum tax, which would have meant that if we didn't extend that relief, we go from about 3 million people who have to pay the alternative minimum tax, which originally was intended just to hit the highest income people, expanded from about 3 million to 40 million people who would be subject to it. Everybody knew that we were going to provide the relief, but he wouldn't reflect that in his budget. In this budget, President Obama reflected all that. He has the cost of the war over the next 10 years. He has the full cost of the alternative minimum tax relief. What this does, in addition to satisfying geeks like me and you say like you, is that it allows us to focus on what's really important about the budget, which is the trade-offs in the budget. We don't end up having to say, hey, look, these numbers are phony. And he's saying, oh, we can, you know, do what I want to do. Bush would say, we can do what I want to do, and look, it's not going to cost but this much. What Obama is saying is, if we do what I want, it's going to cost this much. That's why I've got these offsetting savings in here, because the only way we can get the deficit down is to do some of those savings to offset the cost that I've honestly reflected here. That's a big step forward. We can now have a debate on the policies, on the trade-offs, rather than having the trade-offs obscured by phony numbers.
Now, there is some complaint that we've seen a return of our old friend from the 80s, rosy scenario, that the economic numbers specifically are just a little too optimistic about recovery and expansion. What do you think of that?
There's an incredible amount of uncertainty about what the economy is going to look like over the next few years. And there certainly are some people who think that the administration's assumptions are somewhat optimistic. There are some who think they're not. I think they're absolutely within the range of reasonable assumptions, and I am absolutely convinced by conversations I've had with people, you know, very close to the administration, that they were not the result of the political folks at the White House saying, hey, we've got to have optimistic assumptions. They were the work of the professional economic forecasters at the Council of Economic Advisors, and that they were it's a forecast that those professionals thought was the most reasonable and best, although they certainly acknowledge that there's a great deal of uncertainty. Things could turn out worse than they think. They also could turn out better.
And speaking of which, the combination of recession, which lowers tax revenues and raises regular spending on income support and things like that and Medicaid, plus all the emergency stimulus and financial rescue packages have created a deficit of almost unimaginable proportions. And I actually did the work on this a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about $1 trillion, you almost have no concept of that. If you counted out a $100 bill every second, it would take you 317 years to count to $1 trillion. So we're talking about a lot of money.
Right.
How does this deficit stack up against the past, and what, if anything, can be done about it, you know, assuming we get out of this immediate economic crisis in the next year or two?
This deficit, the best way to measure the size of a deficit over a long period of time is how large is it relative to the size of the economy. And this year it's going to be somewhere around 12 or 13% of GDP, which is the best overall measure of the size of the economy. That is the biggest by a significant margin since World War II. So there is no doubt this is a very large deficit. There's also no doubt that we're in the most serious economic downturn we've seen since the Great Depression. And I think there is a general consensus, you never get unanimity on these things, but a general consensus among economists and budget experts that the steps that have been taken to try and stimulate the economy, to stabilize the financial system, are absolutely necessary. And if that means driving up the deficit to 12 or 13% of GDP this year and still have very large ones next year and the year after, that's a price we have to pay in order to try to keep this from being a recession that is deeper and longer than it has to be. And it's going to be bad in any case. I mean, the stimulus bill and the financial stabilization efforts are not going to turn the economy around immediately. I think we're going to see unemployment continue to rise for a while. We're going to see the economy continue to sink. But I do believe, as the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has just opined, that the stimulus bill will make a significant difference, that we could have up to 3.6 million more people employed by the end of next year than we would have had without it. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to be anywhere near full employment again, but that we'd be better off than we would have been. And
it could be a slower rate of job loss rather than actual job gains.
Absolutely. And that's people sometimes talk about new jobs created. Well, what you want to do here is try to save a lot of existing jobs as well as create some new jobs. And there's going to be a lot of arguing over this because, of course, there's going to be no way to know for sure what would have happened in the absence of the stimulus bill. But I think the consensus is if we hadn't done the stimulus, we would be looking at a really steep decline and long-lasting recession, and that this will help us keep it from getting as deep as it would have and get us out of it faster, and that the added deficit and the added amount that adds to our debt, while it's not a good thing, it's something that's necessary and it's worthwhile to try to alleviate the misery that could be caused by a really deep and long-lasting recession.
And we're just about out of time, but let me see if you agree with this. There are a lot of people who say this is going to bankrupt us. My sense is that we could afford this for a few years, then we have to straighten things out after that period is over.
That's absolutely right. We here at the Center have done over time long-term budget projections where we look out 50 years. We did an update last December, and we did a little exercise recently where we said, okay, how much difference does the added cost of the stimulus bill add to that long term? And in fact, it added very little to the long term, only about 4% increase in the size of the long term problem. And that's because it is temporary. The added costs are temporary, where what's driving the long term problem are the long term permanent cost of increasing health care costs. So we got to deal with the long term problem. The short term problems we're having in the stimulus will add to the debt, but they don't really have a big impact on that long term. What is absolutely crucial, though, is that we do keep these things temporary, and as we start coming out of this, we get the deficit down, as the president's budget proposes, and at the same time that we demonstrate that we are willing to start making the changes in health care and the tax policy that will alleviate those long-term deficits so that the people who lend to us will see we're serious about getting the long-term deficit down and not continuing to borrow massive amounts for decades to come.
All right, we got to end it there. Thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with James Horney, who is the top fiscal policy expert at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back next week, and let's go out with this from the great Lauren Flax, a bit of Yellow Doors 03. Till next week. Bye.